okay, a little bit of excitement to end the semester. One question I just got that may be relevant to some others of you is that when you generate code and generate the .j file, you then have to go through Jasmine to create a .class file and then run it. Now what happens is in the build.xml, I have a couple of versions of test. Test by itself just takes a very simple light program and compiles it, assembles it, and runs it just to verify everything's in place and that it can work. Test one intentionally will go through the code generator and list the generated code, but then it stops. The reason for that is in many cases, you may not have all your code generation implemented, and you're creating an incomplete .j file. So all that would happen is Jasmine would find errors, give you error messages, and confuse you unnecessarily. It's saying it's not complete, but you know it's complete. On the other hand, if you do test two, that will go ahead and generate the code, then run Jasmine, then start to execute. There maybe should be another one, but there's something that I wrote to Piazza yesterday that says, well, what do we do if we have a couple of cases that have input? And I'll refer you to Piazza. There are three ways of doing that. One of them is there's an option in the call to Java that specifies exactly the characters you want input to be able to read. Alternatively, you can simply say, don't read from input, which is the standard input, interactive usually, but read from the contents of a file. And you get to say, read file such and such. So reading from input is the same as reading from file such and such. And you can put anything you care to in there. The third thing is if you have access to a command line. Certainly if you're running Macs, you do. I think the stuff that some gentlemen set up to get at Java P would also work for getting to Java. And that is simply at the command line, go into the bin directory that has the .class file associated with the output from Jasmine. So if the class you were compiling was foo, then it would create first a foo.j, Jasmine would convert that to foo.class. Is foo a bad thing to say here? Obviously. It's foobar, because if you ever had to explain what foobar means, but foo is a common computer science nonsense word. Well, anyway, you go in there, you just say Java foo without the dot class, because the stupid thing will go crazy if it sees the dot class. And then it'll start running, and it should accept standard input just from the keyboard as if you were just running a command line version of a program. So those are three ways if you have to read input. Most, but not all, the programs do not need to read input, but several of them do to test the reading, obviously. So that's how you do that. So I know at least a few people were getting programs to run. Is that correct? I saw somebody in office hours, just the very simple ones that does a simple print or something. And tell me, isn't it one of the coolest things when the first time you get one of those things to run? It reminds me of the old days, way back for me, when I was first learning to ride a bicycle. And if I was one of those things, I got a bicycle, but nobody showed me how to run it. So I would push away and tip. And finally, I had the guts to give it a good push and start pedaling like mad, and it actually worked. And that's sort of like in this class where you finally get something to generate, and then you generate more and more, and before you know it, you can generate anything that CSX can program, which is just about anything. It turns out it's theoretically at least a powerful language. So anyway, that's where things stand. I had a couple announcements which I would have overheaded you, but the equipment isn't here. There's a special lamp and stuff and whatever. I don't do the AV guy's job and they don't do mine. So let me just remind you, the semester is winding down pretty quickly. After today, there's next week, the final lecture. What I'll be doing today is going through primarily the remaining code generation handouts. The goal here is to get everything discussed, so you're in a position now to generate code for anything and everything. Next Monday, the 4th, is the EPIC Computer Science EPIC Picnic. It's kind of a nice trade-off. You guys provide the food, and we provide the mouths, and it's a nice combination there. But anyway, what happens, that's being held during our office hours, so I'll be here for sure, but I'll be wherever the picnic is, and if you have office hour type questions, just find me, and between munches, we'll discuss it. In fact, does anybody know where they're holding the picnic? I haven't gotten an email yet, but usually they solicit volunteers and put some notice locally. Has anybody got any info on where it's going to be? Well, maybe they're going to cancel it at the last minute, and market conditions and all. So at any rate, after that, next week we're going to have, and then the week after we're going to have two sittings of the final exam. Now again, please don't get confused. You don't take both of them. You take your choice. So one is fairly early. It's next Wednesday, the 6th. So it's a week from tomorrow. I scheduled that one early to maximize the distance between the two exams because I've been warned that people are in and out and sometimes it's an extended period of time. So the first offering will be next Wednesday, the 6th, in this room, 5:30 to 7:30. And I'll come in earlier so that if anybody has any last-minute questions that aren't handled by office hours, we'll have office hours this week on Thursday, next week on Monday, but with a picnic, you know, that's a little less well-structured. The second final, if you prefer that one, will be Tuesday the 12th. I stretched it out as far as I could, but we still have to have time to grade it and get the final grades put together to keep the university happy. And I expect the final grades will be out around the end of next week, say the 15th or the 16th. 15th is a Friday, 16th is a Saturday, and depending on how things go together, that should be taken care of. I got email just as I was coming in that the TA has finished grading Project 4. Are those grades listed on Learn at UW? Yes, okay. So you can check that. I haven't printed out the sheets yet. Those will be available on Thursday or next week if you want to pick them up. And he also has a little discussion of what people did. I think the summary is people did pretty well. Virtually nobody got perfect. And that's not surprising because the trouble with doing type checking is it's innumerable independent rules. So just because you have the first 20 done right is no guarantee that the 21st will be done right. So lots of little things, you know, that just, you know, like civic laws or something, no matter how honest you think you are, they can find you did something or other wrong. You know, you drank a cup of soda and you didn't declare it as income on your taxes because, you know, gift in kind is supposed to be taxable, things like that. So at any rate, people have done well on that. If you want, at this stage, since it's already been graded, I'll send you a working Project 4 if you need it. But as I warned, I'm not going to do any testing of type errors in Project 5 tests, the full CSX. There may be some errors in terms of limitations. For example, I think there's a limit of how many local variables you can have in a particular method imposed by the JVM. I'm trying to remember the number. It's a reasonable number, but not a huge number. So if you try to have, for example, 10,000 distinct local variables, that would almost certainly make the thing go belly up. And those sorts of limitations, you're not required to do something that the infrastructure does not support. So there's a slight chance you could get during code generation an error. But for the most part, if it's gotten through scanning and parsing and type checking, it's a valid program. Your job is to put it in executable form. As you all know, that's not a guarantee the program will run as expected. There's a big difference from the compiler saying, I translated the program, and the user saying, ah, that's just what I wanted. But that's not news to you. So we'll be testing to make sure that, you know, the programs run correctly. There's any number of very simple programs that you can pretty much tell if they're working or not because it tries one little feature and, you know, it oftentimes has comments saying, I'm going to do this or I'm going to do that. Yeah. Yeah. I think so. I haven't looked at them in details. Don't let it matter because it all gets scaled. Yeah. So it turns out one of the indirect things you learn is that all this formalization, you thought regular expressions and grammars and all that were pretty fancy stuff. But the advantage of all that, once you got it in that form, the implementation is automatic. The case of something like type checking, it's not all formalized. It's English language or human language. It says, this is required, and that's required, and that's required. And it's up to you to take the language form, put it in implementable form, and put it all together in a consistent application of the rules. So that's not easy. And a lot of cases, there's still oddball rules about what happens on corner cases. Am I allowed, for example, in very early languages, versions of Fortran, you had arrays that had multiple dimensions. But not many people knew it, but you were limited in early Fortran to having three different dimensions, X, Y, and Z using conventional terminology. Can anybody guess why they had only three dimensions? Because if you went to four or more in any kind of decent-sized array, you'd run out of memory. Just remember, you know, if you have 100 by 100 by 100, that's bad enough, but 100 by 100 by 100 by 100 is something. So that was sort of they said nobody's ever going to need that much, that complex a program, so we won't allow it. These days, I think they're more flexible in languages that have multiple dimensional arrays. There still may be a limit. It might be 99 or 256 or something. But those are sort of the obscure rules that language designers or language implementers have to end up working with. So anyway, let me go over here and see if I can find our material and get working from there. Is that convenient enough, or do you want it a little bit bigger? Yeah. Bigger still? Is that good? I, by the way, have paper copies, so anybody needs paper copies and don't have them, I can give you that, or fish out your own paper copies if you have them. Yeah. You want part two, right? In preparing for today's lecture, I found one error that I'll get to later when we find it. In fact, I'll play one of these games. What's wrong with this picture? Do they still do that? They used to do that when I was a kid. They'd have a picture of what's wrong with this picture, and you'd sit in a situation to see what was going wrong. Let me get to where we were. Yeah, we were just at loops. So this is probably a good place to begin, because this is one of the first spots where we actually get into the dynamic notion of programs. We've been talking about loops almost from the beginning of the language. We first had to scan things like the word while, then we had to do the syntax for while, and then we had to type check a while. But if you notice up to this point, there's nothing about whiles that had anything to do with looping. Looping is some sort of notion of repetition, and that there's nothing that we saw so far about repetition. This is the spot where we actually go from the notion of what the structure is to what the thing is actually meant to do. So one of the more common things that people do when they invent a new structure, these of course are very old and very well established, but they sort of scratch their heads and say, what do I dynamically want the program to do? That is, if I view the execution, it's going to be here, it's going to be there. Because it's looping, there's probably going to be some way to repeat the loop some number of times. That's typically done with a transfer of control. So what people first do is come up with a structure. And here's the structure I'll use up here for implementing a while loop. And actually, as I show you the structure, we'll be able to answer a couple of fairly elementary questions. But again, questions that weren't necessarily obvious until we get into the translation of it. So this L whatever with a number colon is a label. Assembly language oftentimes has labels because when you get down to the low-level details, there are transfers of control. The user does not necessarily see labels because most whiles, unless they have labels for breaks or continues, don't show them to the user. But they're still hidden underneath. And moreover, because of the rule that you cannot redefine identifiers, although I show you L1 and L2 here, each and every time I generate a while loop, be they sequential or nested, I'm going to have to use different labels. So as you'll see a bit later, I have a generator that says, give me a unique label. It's simply label 1, label 2, up to as big a suffix as you want. So I can have as many labels as I want, and each one is defined once by being placed at a particular point in the code. So I have two labels in the loop, and that sort of makes sense. One is oftentimes called the top, and guess what the other one is called? The bottom. Isn't that clever notation? And as you might imagine, the top is used to go back to repeat. The bottom is used typically to exit. So L2 is just beyond the extent of the loop. And then when I want to get out of the loop by either normal termination or by doing a break, I transfer control to the L2. What that means is I execute instructions whose effect is not to necessarily compute a value, not to load something onto the stack or remove something from the stack, but rather simply to say the next instruction I execute will not be the normal in-order sequential, but at a point that I designate. That's called a go-to, a jump, a branch. Lots of different words use it, but it's very fundamental at the assembly language level. So the way I have things laid out here is the things in braces are just commentary that says, at this point, I'm going to generate some code to do a particular thing. I'm not going to generate myself. Whoever's in charge of whatever the construct that appears there is in charge of it. So I'm going to generate the stuff outside the braces, and I'm going to call subtrees and say, please give me a Boolean value on the stack, of course, or please generate code for the then part, not the then part, but the body part of the loop. So it says, I'm going to generate a label representing the top of the expression. And then it says, in braces, evaluate the control expression. Type checking already knows that's a Boolean, so it's a 0 or a 1 sitting on top of the operand stack, and I'll be able to examine that. This, by the way, explains something that you may not have thought about. This is a sort of loop that can be executed 0 times. Some loops can be executed at least once, or must be executed at least once, with additional iterations if you want them. Those are called repeat until. If you look at some old exams, there may be questions of saying, oh, hey, you already took the class, you know how to do while loops, show me how you do a repeat until loop. And that's something that potentially might or might not appear on the exam. But looking through old exams, I saw it there in previous years. So I'm going to call something that evaluates an expression, particularly a Boolean expression, and it'll generate maybe a very trivial instruction, like load a Boolean variable from a label or load a Boolean variable from a local variable in the current frame, but put a 0 or a 1 on the stack. I then execute this instruction. This is a conditional branch. The if says on its conditional, EQ is obviously equal. It doesn't say equal to what. So what would you imagine the magic number is if I say equal to something and I'm not telling you what? What's likely to be the magic number? Could be 1 or 0. It turns out to be 0. You know, computers love zeros for some reason. So it's saying if the top of the stack is equal to 0, conditionally branch to L2. That means ignore all the stuff between where you are and where L2 is specified and continue executing there. So that's how you terminate a loop. It says while something is true, do the body. As soon as it hits false, don't do the body. Assuming that this does not branch, the normal flow of control is sequentially top to bottom. So here I'll generate code for the loop body. It can be as complex as I want. And when I get done with that, I'll go to L1 unconditionally. And that says, in this case, I'm going to go ahead and reevaluate the termination condition to see if it's now time to terminate, under the assumption that the body of the loop may have changed the termination condition. Of course, there's no guarantees. This code may do what's called an infinite loop. And you've all probably had experience with infinite loops. In fact, I had one in a very unexpected place on my DVR on my cable box. I had a cable box and a situation I told it to delete something after I watched it, and it wouldn't delete. Tried it again, it wouldn't delete. So I kind of half knew I was getting myself into trouble. So I went down to a list of all the programs I want to keep and all the ones I want to delete, and I ticked everything I want to keep except the bad one. And what happened? Went to an infinite loop. It went through there and said, well, I'm going to delete all those. Oh, nope, you still got one more to delete. I'm going to go through it. And what do you do when you have an infinite loop besides curse and darn or damn all computer people, except us, of course? I rebooted it. Except that this thing, rebooting and turning it off wouldn't work because in many things, turning it off doesn't really turn it off. It's a cable box. So I had to do the ultimate, pull the old plug, put it back in, and then I reboot it and reload, and son of a gun, it was working again. So infinite loops are everywhere, and you know we can generate them this way. We don't intentionally do it, but it's still possible. And that's not our responsibility. If the user asks us to do something where it goes through an infinite loop, we are pretty much required to do it. There's a famous theorem in computer science that says determining whether or not a particular program terminates or not, it's called the halting problem in fancy terminology, is something that's theoretically impossible to do. That's perhaps something that'll be covered this summer. Because it's really kind of a cool idea. There are questions, I mean, not esoteric questions, you're not like, is there a God, or when will I die, or will the Brewers ever win another game, or anything like that. But very simple, mathematically sounding things, like here's a program, I'll give you all the data, I'll give you as much memory as you want, no limitations on that, and you just tell me, will this loop, once it starts iterating, stop or not? And it's actually possible to prove that cannot be done. You can test for some cases, obviously some trivial cases, but the general case, that's a question which is unanswerable. And mathematicians have studied this. Some of you have math backgrounds, you know about this. There's all kinds of cool stuff. But in this case, it's not our responsibility. We know this is a powerful construct, but looping is one of those things that's so fundamental that every language is going to have it in some form. So at any rate, this will be our goal to generate. Any questions just about what the code is meant to do? You have to be able to look at the code and say, yeah, this looks right or this looks wrong. So here's how we're going to implement it. We're first going to have a label counter. Notice, hi. Can you start that up on the other panel and not kill this one? That other monitor. Or do we have one computer or two? I guess we only have one box. This may or may not work as expected. We'll see. So anyway, while he's doing that, and I saw something on the screen, I'll keep talking. So that first line is essentially a counter. Notice it's meant to be static, and it's put in the code-generating class as a global shared variable. So this means it retains state. So that means as I go ahead and call the code generator again and again and again for different loops, it'll remember what the last previous number was. And you'll notice that when I have something called generate a label, it means generate me a brand new label name. So effectively, it prepends an L. So all our labels will look like L, blah, 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 blah. We're safe in doing that because notice that labels always have the special dollar sign appended to it. And I know just from reading through the manual that there are no Jasmine reserved words or operators that are of the form L, digit, digit, digit. So I can just use that and be assured that I'm not going to trip across any numbers that the user uses. Notice the user could actually use a variable like L1 or L2 or something, but that's not going to matter because this has long since been put into the symbol table and translated into a symbol table entry, and the fact that that label name existed is no longer relevant. The user won't normally see those numbers, so there should be no confusion. This is stuff we're generating. We may have to look at it for debugging, but normally the user won't see it at all. So we generate a label that says, create me a new label name. But question is, where do we place it? The third one says define label, says put a label definition point at this point in the program. So what it'll do is it'll take the label. Just remember it was, and I'll see how good my memory was. It's one of these things. So at this case, we'd actually put a label with a colon. Notice that colon is important because that shows it's a label. So that third line, label colon, churns out, as you're learning now, into some sort of print to the ASM file. It says, I'm going to print a line. And typically, you put that on a separate line, but you don't need to. You can have a label and then an opcode following if you prefer. So that's how we'll actually create labels. A branch Z, what do you suppose Z stands for? Zero, or maybe Zebua, but in this case, it actually zero. So it branch Z says, if you have a zero, where do you have a zero? On the operand stack, then go ahead and branch to that label, and I'll give you that as a parameter. So this is a way, for example, to terminate a loop or go back to the head of, I guess in this case, to terminate a loop, it says, once you've turned false, go ahead and exit your way out. So, and that's generated as our old if equal. So if equal means if equal to zero and branch to that label. I don't know if things are solved or not, but I also have an unconditional branch at the very top. And that just generates a go-to. So go-to is like a jump or a branch. Different languages have different synonyms, but they mean the same thing. And finally, look at this. It's a case here where this is all the code we have to generate, all the code generation we have to do to generate a complete while loop. And that includes, you know, labels and all that. So what we do is we first create two brand new labels called top and bottom. But they're really L some number and L some number plus one. And we say in this case, is it the case that this loop has a user-specified label? How do I tell that? Well, I go ahead and look at the subtree where the user would have put the label and say, are you null or not? If you're not null, if you're not null, that means you had a label. And I take those two generated labels and store them in the symbol table entry for the user's label. That's because those labels are going to be very valuable when I do a break or continue. And imagine I'll use one for one case and one for the other. So I just store those away because when I get around to processing the body, that's where the breaks and continues will appear, and I want to have that information at hand. So I then go ahead and define the top label. So now the top label is in place. I then do a visit on the condition subtree. That's going to generate enough code to put a Boolean on top of the operand stack. I then say, if the top of the operand stack is zero, that means false, branch to a point that's going to represent the exit point of the loop. So that's called bottom. But of course, bottom is really just at the very bottom of the loop. I then visit the body of the loop and translate it. I branch unconditionally to the top. That'll allow me to go back and reevaluate my termination condition. And then after that, I define a second label representing the bottom point of the label, actually just a little bit past the bottom of the loop, as the exit point. Okay, that's pretty straightforward. But here's a question. People sometimes write nested loops. That's very common, particularly when you have the for loop variation. You have maybe one iteration representing X coordinates, another the Y, maybe the Z, maybe a fourth coordinate for time. That's often the way people do simulations. If you're simulating something like the weather or the birth of the universe or whatever it might happen to be, you have very deeply nested loops that simply go through there for each point in three space and each time that I care about, figure out what the relevant parameters were at that instance. So at that particular point, I have nested loops. Does this code work for nested loops? It should. But what is it? I mean, what if the loops get messed up? Notice that if I have two nested while loops, before the second one is finished, I'll have started processing the inner one. So I have while, blah, 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 then a second while, end, and then the end of the outer one. Are they going to step on each other's toes? And the answer is no, because the only thing that could possibly get in the way are those labels. But notice I generate brand new unique labels each time, and I store them away so I have them available as local variables. So the inner loop, if it branches to exit some point, or the outer loop, if it branches to exit, will go to different points. And this means nesting works perfectly fine, no extra thought or consideration required. And even better, look at those breaks and continues. How could you possibly do better than that? Each break and continue is implemented by essentially one instruction. Minus the boilerplate to just define the method. So what does a break mean? A break says, break me out of this loop. You know, saying, give me a break, let me out of here. How do you do it? You jump to the bottom label, which is just beyond the loop. So anytime you execute a break, this is get out of the loop right now, that's how you do it. A continue says, I want to continue with the next iteration, but I don't want to do the rest of the body. So oftentimes you have a loop that's looking for something. You're searching around, nah, this one's not going to work. Let's try the next iteration. No, that's not going to work. Let's try the next, et cetera. And a continue says, I'll continue with the next iteration. That takes me to the top label. I reevaluate my termination condition to make sure, of course, that if I'm meant to terminate, that I don't loop forever. And that's all it is. So if you organize things right, it's really very simple to have what look like fairly complex structures. Probably before you ever got into class, you would have thought that generating code for something as important as a while loop, and it turns out the for loop is not much different. I have some notes, if you haven't read ahead, the set of notes, which I probably won't get to today, but I should next week, that talk about various code generation improvements. One of them is how do you extend the while loop to do a for loop? That's something some of you might want to do as extra credit. It's not that much harder. A for loop is just a while loop with a little initialization up top and a little bit of increment code at the point where you say, let's go ahead and try another iteration before I go ahead and check the termination. But it's really very simple additions, and therefore for loops, which are used quite routinely, are about as difficult as this. Maybe a tad more difficult, but certainly not humongous in any way. You can also use much the same approach for if statements. And here's a case where we'll get to where you can actually do an improvement. You know, I don't think this guy's coming back, so does anybody have any idea how, if I were to suspend this thing, I would turn on the document camera? Now, let me see if, let me minimize this for a moment. So I've got log on. Does any of this stuff look familiar? Local disk, log off, presentations. It's got to be something on here. What about these little gizmos down here? What's this thing? Zoom it? Nah. Well, maybe we'll fool around with this between sessions. Like, it'd be nice to have the document camera going, and I've almost got it, and all I have to do is the last step. So anyway, we were talking about conditional statements. This is if then and if then else's. So again, the first thing we'll do is look at the code we wish to generate. So in this particular case, we have a Boolean value controlling the condition. So we generate whatever code we need to get a Boolean, a 0 or 1, on the operand stack. Here's our old buddy if equal to 0. So he says if this is false, you don't do the then part. You go ahead and do the else part, and it turns out L1 will be a label that will separate the then part and the else part. So it says skip over the code for the then, maybe a little, maybe a lot, and then do the else part. Otherwise, what happens is if it's true, you do the then part. A common error when you're first putting the compiler together is to do the then part and also do the else part, because you forget about this little guy here. Namely, if I do the then, I don't do the else, I have to jump around it. So I have a second label that represents the very bottom of the expression that goes ahead and generates code for the else part. So let's go ahead and look at the generate code, and then we'll talk about a little optimization. And it's very easy to put in, and it's always nice when you hand in something that says, oh, I've got extra credit, you know, in the situation. Maybe not extra credit, but extra credit. So we'll get into that in just a moment. And it's a very simple and reasonable optimization. Okay, but here's the code. And again, it's not that very difficult. This is roughly not even half a page. So again, I'm going to have two labels, which I call the end, that represents the end of the if, and else, which represents the else part. I visit the conditional, getting a Boolean on the stack. I define what the else label is going to be, and I do a conditional branch if it's 0. So if the condition is false, I do the else part, and I do that by branching at this point to the else label. I then generate the then part. The else part. So in this case, I generate a label and branch to it unconditionally. I then translate the else part, and in this particular case, I define a label for it, I translate it, and then go ahead and define the end label. So it all works out pretty well. A little trick about this, when you're looking at something like this, it's good if you have the kind of code I have up here. And again, if I had my document camera going, I would show that. Take each piece and kind of check it off to make sure somebody is responsible for generating that. So did the guy that is responsible for generating the conditional get called? Yeah, that was the visit to the conditional. So yeah, he did that. I had to create a label L1 and do a conditional branch on 0 to it. I did that. Translate the code for the then part. Unconditional branch to the bottom of the loop. L1 is the label for the else part and the code for the else part, and away we go. Okay, a couple of questions. One is a correctness sort of thing. Actually, I have a couple, you know, because of the things. First of all, will nested loops work properly? It's very common to have an if that has another if that has another if. Will that all work properly? And the answer is yes, it will, because notice the only thing that really varies are the labels, and we generate fresh labels each time. If you're not really convinced of that, you should probably at some point just on the side do an if and another if and just sort of hand translate it to make sure that it all fits together. But the answer is yes, it will work. Will this work properly for if then, but without an else? Notice we only have one structure, an if then else, and the trick we play is if we don't have an else part, the else part is null. And that's okay. We know that if you go ahead to a null node and try to do something with it, it always does nothing. There's always sort of a null method. This is code generator for a null node is always do nothing. So in this case, when I looked at the code generation, although I could have, I didn't even have to ask, Mr. Else, are you null? Because what happens is it can inherit, in this case, a code generator that says, I do nothing. So you call him and he returns and it has a net effect. If you wanted to, you could put a conditional around the spot where you translate the else part, where you do the visit to the else part, but you don't have to, because things can be null, and if you go ahead and visit them and they're null, they generally do nothing. So they don't work if I have an if and else. Will the code be correct? Let's look at this. What's going to happen if I have no else part? It means when I said generate code for the else part, nothing happened. I got empty sequence. So this means this thing effectively goes away. Is the code I have still correct? It better be, because if-thens are common enough that I better handle them correctly. So will this work? The answer is yes, but it is a tad inefficient, and that's the basis for your optimization. What's it going to do? It's going to say go to L2, where L2 is the very next instruction you would execute anyway. That's perfectly valid. The CPU always has this rule that unless you do some sort of branch instruction, you execute in sequence. So I look at instruction 1, then instruction 2, and instruction 3 in sequence from low to high, just going through memory. So it would have gone ahead and done this go-to anyway. So what I wanted to is an optimization, and here you can make a little note, it's a very straightforward change, is saying I can go ahead and check if the else part is null. How do I do that? I just go down there and say, Mr. Else part, are you null? Remember that is null business, and he'll truthfully tell you, yes, I am, or no, I'm not. So he says, I'm null. Well, in that particular case, then going to L2 to jump around the else part is totally unnecessary. So I can suppress this guy. I don't generate any code, and I don't even have to generate L2, because the only guy that cared about L2 was the go-to, and it didn't use it. I may have already defined the label. I'm generated the label number, but I don't define it anyway. So in this case, all it amounts to is, if something's false, the L1 now becomes effectively the exit point of the if-then. So it says, if something is true, do something, otherwise do nothing at all. So if it's false, I jump around the then part, and I'm out of the if-then, and that works properly. So question? It varies a whole lot on the processor and situation there. I don't think this is too bad. I know conditional branches sometimes screw up processors because they have this notion of processing ahead, and they have an instruction queue that they have to worry about, instruction cache in particular. So you guys have caches, but the people in computer architecture have caches, and those are very important. But it's a very good point, though. Go-tos, although they look pretty benign, can have a bigger expense than you might imagine. In this case, I don't think that's that bad because it's to the very next instruction. But you're right. I mean, and it's actually true that, I haven't gotten into this, but it's an important point, that sometimes people rearrange the code generated to avoid consecutive go-tos. I think in the code we generated, did we have that? Let me go back just since this came up. Oops, right here, so easy. Notice that in this case, this is valid code, but apropos to what was suggested, if go-tos are more expensive than you know, imagine, I'm doing something fairly, I won't say silly, but fairly inefficient. Namely, I'm doing an unconditional branch to get to a conditional branch. Maybe if I was a tad clever, I could have taken that go-to L1 and that if equal L2 and combined them into one conditional branch. And that way I would have fewer instructions and I would disrupt the flow of control a little bit less. The problem with that is, assuming you transfer this into a conditional branch, that means at the very start you have to jump around the body to anticipate the possibility you'll execute 0 times. But that's okay because you only do that once. So actually, here's another optimization, if you're sensitive to this, is that you can come up with an alternative version, which, on the assumption that you execute the loop many times, many, I don't know, maybe 10, that's not many in computer terms, but enough that that this sequence is relevant, taking this go to L1 and the if equal L2 and translating it into an alternative single conditional with a branch around is worth the bother. The code's a tad more clumsy. I chose this form because it's so darn simple to see that everybody says, yeah, it's obviously right. But that's a good point. And here's where compiler writers do this all the time if they have some notion of how expensive the operations are. And that's something, again, you could do as extra credit. And in general, if you had a loop that executed not 10 or 20, but millions or billions of times, that would probably be a noticeable difference. Talked about brace and continues. Okay, we talk about typecasts and relational operators. In this particular case, we have sort of an odd way that the architecture we have does a comparison. You'd expect if I wanted to have something like is A equal to B, I'd push A, I'd push B, and then I'd say compare these things for equality and leave a Boolean on the stack. And in fact, when we implement it, that's the effect we'll have. But it's not the effect that the JVM really gives us automatically. Yeah, I appreciate it, the situation. So we'll be talking there. So what's happening here is that the way the JVM actually has comparisons done are not by conditionals that load a Boolean. That might seem like it's a natural thing to do, but actually these guys are pretty smart because we're going to see that there's a better way of doing it. And what that does is it does loads two values and does a conditional branch based on the relationship. So we could have something, for example, if these guys are equal, branch here. If it could be the fact that I want them to be not equal, I do the inverse of that and see if they're not equal, branch here. So the effect will be to branch to one point if a relation is satisfied and to continue execution in sequence if it's not. And that's the way we'll have to do comparisons because that's what the JVM gives us. Oh, good, it's back. So in this particular case, I go ahead and look at the actual code that our scanner set up for the various relational operators, six of them, equal, not equal, less than, greater than, blah, blah, blah. And it actually fishes out the letter codes that the JVM expects. So it just turns out somebody chose those letters. They're fairly reasonable, so no complaint there. And what you do is you generate an if integer compare, and this plus says I have to suffix on a couple of letters. So I'd have if integer compare equal. It says take the top two operands, pop them off, do an integer compare. Turns out they're equal, go ahead and branch you to that label. Otherwise, fall through. And it happens that that's the way that the JVM will actually go ahead. Is there any way I can? Oh, can I just put them on top? Cool. Okay, you can have the mouse back. Oh, he's got it going. Cool. Yeah. Excellent. So let me. Looks fine. I think so. Better than we had previously. Yeah, thanks a lot. Yeah. I hope none of you go crazy with this. Can you see that? Yeah. I think they supposed to have a different sort of lamp. There's what you're seeing there is a 60 cycle flutter in the fluorescent light. So I hope none of you, or particularly me, gets put into any kind of convulsions or hypnotic state or something like that. Whatever. At this stage, we'll be pleased to have what we have. I'm just looking for the black pen that I thought I had. Oh, there it is. Cool. Okay, so we're back. So what's going to happen here is that if I have to generate a relational operator, what I'm going to have to do is something which I'll admit straight away is silly, but it's forced upon me on the way we have our translation. But then I'm going to show you, our class notes have it, and I'll show you probably next week or maybe at the very end today, is how to generate a relational operator effectively. So all I'm going to show you how to do is implement something like A equal B. And here's the problem. Our definition says the meaning of A equal B is put A and B on the operand stack, compare them, and leave a Boolean. And that's exactly what we're going to do. But it turns out that that's not the way people use relationals in most cases. Rather than saying, I don't really want the Boolean, I want something to do a conditional branch, because usually you're going to do this something like an if. And the folks who invented these relational operators said in most cases comparisons are used in the context of an if or some kind of while or for or something, and therefore we'll try to make the common case efficient. So what we're going to do here is just do what our instructions tell us to do. We're essentially going to set up an if-then-else expression that uses conditional branches to push a 1 or a 0, that is true or false, onto a stack. So if you remember just a bit ago, we happened to have an if statement, and this is going to look very much like an if statement. In fact, it's going to look kind of like an if expression. And by the by, when you're preparing for the exam, if you look at old exams, one of the more common questions I've asked in the past is, okay, you know how to do an if statement. Do you know how to do an if expression? Remember, an if expression is something where you test a conditional and return one or two values. So instead of doing a statement, you do a value. And I always forget what it is. Let's see if I remember. So it's like A equal B question mark true. And what is it, a colon? Is that it? I know it exists, but I don't use it that much. So this is a conditional expression. And it's very much like a conditional statement, except you leave values on the stack instead of executing code. But it's something that's useful and certainly does exist in most languages. And a couple of people shook their heads, which means they probably actually have used it. But the translation is a true lab and a skip. I do the comparison, and it says, this guy's is true. I'm going to skip around a load I. Remember, what load I is, put an integer literal on the operand stack. So pushing false. It'll then branch around that. So it'll, if it's true, it'll push a 1 defined as true lab and skip. So effectively, it's an if-then-else statement that pushes a 0 or a 1. Pushes a 1 for the then part if it's true, a 0 for the else part if it's false. So in this particular case, I then have to extend my binary operator node, which we did way back when, to say if you're the special case of a relational operator, how do I tell that? I simply take the opcode, and if it doesn't return me a two-letter code, the default is to return null string. That means I'm not one of these six magic operators, do the usual sort of translation. Otherwise, generate the relational. So in this case, in many cases, I push, and do an operation like add or subtract, multiply or divide. But I can also push, and then generate this gobbledygook to do a conditional branch to get a 0 or 1 on the stack. What's particularly disgusting about this is after I've done the conditional branches to put a 0 or 1 on the stack, I almost certainly have something like an if statement. And what does an if statement do? It says, okay, hey, I've got a 0 or 1 on top of the stack. I'm going to do a conditional branch. So notice what we're doing. It works, but it's ugly, and that's why I'm going to talk next time about a much more clever and efficient way of doing it called jump code. So what this guy is going to do is use conditional branches to put a 0, 1 on the stack, and then use conditional branches to decide whether it's going to do the then part or the else part. Obviously, the better thing to have done is when it was doing these comparisons and did the conditional branch directly to the then part or the else part, and never actually realize a 0 or 1 on the stack. And it turns out that's very useful, but it's also kind of a very subtle thing. I don't know if any of you ever had to worry about things like information leaks. One of the odd things we have in computer business is we're very generous in who we let in the door, particularly your company here. I mean, you let anybody in the door. If they let me in, they let anybody in a situation there. But I mean, it's a situation, if you were in a small town, it might be the case that when you're growing up, your parents did not lock the door at night. I grew up in the inner city of Buffalo. You better believe we locked the doors at night. You know, put the bolts on, got the guard dogs out and everything else, you know, just being prepared. So in the old days, people were very trusting. Modern days, they're not. But people download programs all the time, and the notion is, yeah, I'll download it, but I'm going to make sure it's a good program and not a bad program before I go ahead and let it do something. Well, how do you tell if something's good or bad? In some cases, you can tell it by what it returns. Like if you run the thing and all of a sudden you see your social security number coming out digit by digit, or you know, when you've got one of the great American Express cards. What's the really great American Express card? There's the usual kind, but there's the kind you have if you're super rich. Excuse me? Yeah, I think that's it. I mean, this is the sort of thing where they don't even bother checking your credit. You know, if you've got enough money, you could buy the company, don't forget about it, and anything at all. So if you see the digits of whatever this card is coming floating by, you say, uh-oh, I'm in trouble. So one of the simple tests is run the darn thing and see what it returns. But notice what this is showing here is that it's not necessarily has to return values in an obvious form. One way you could sneak out a little bit of information is not by values it returns, but where it goes. For example, if I wanted to sneak out your Social Security number, one way to do it was I'd run a program that would go ahead and print something out very benignly, like the current weather in Verona is. And you say, oh, golly, that's just a weather program. That's fine. But what happens is the speed at which you print out those letters, the current weather is, can encode information. Like if it comes out real fast, maybe it's a zero, not so a little slower, it's a one. And by the timing of how fast this comes back, you say, oh, gosh, the internet is sluggish again. It must be, you know, something is goofed up. So there's all kinds of ways. And this sounds silly, but people analyzing programs say, how can I tell if a program's bad? And what jump code tells us is it's not just returning numbers like 0, 1 on the stack. It can be very subtle things like where it is or how fast it responds or what benign things it has. For example, if it asks for what gives you the weather in Verona, it means one thing. If it gives you the weather in Madison, it means a second thing. In Fitchburg, a third. Very benign looking, but still the information there. So this is a much tougher business. I'm sure many of you realize that than you might at first glance. So at any rate, we're going to improve upon this, but at this stage now, the way we get evaluation of something like a conditional expression, because we are forced to use the JVM and we're forced to use my silly semantics initially that says, what does this mean? It means put a 0 or 1 on the stack independent of who cares to use it. That's the sort of thing we can improve upon. If that's the case, then we'll go ahead and do this thing about first generating a relational operator, put a 0 or 1 using conditional branches, and then test it and do a second set of conditional branches to do a while termination or then part or an else part. A couple of other things we'll be done with this particular guy. We have to do cast nodes. That's where we change the apparent type of an expression. In this case, we have some very limited things. Integer, char, and bools can be translated across each other. The two really only difficult cases are that I'm trying to convert an integer or a char into a Boolean. The rule there is if the value had all zeros, it's false. Otherwise, it's true. And guess what? I do the old general relational operator business, another conditional branch to get a zero or a one. The other case I had a question about this is, what does it mean to convert an integer like 1, 2, 3, 4 into a character? Yeah, by casting it. So in this case, I'd say I have 1, 2, 3, 4, and please make a char out of that. The way that it's normally interpreted is we first take 1, 2, 3, 4 and interpret it as Boolean, as bits. So whatever this would be some number of bits and bytes. And what we would do is extract the rightmost 7 bits, because 7 bits is exactly what an ASCII character requires. And the way we do that is we put 127, which is equal to 7 consecutive bits on the right end in a binary form, and generate an AND instruction. Remember how AND works is that 0 AND anything is anything. Oh, I'm sorry, 0 AND anything is 0. 1 AND anything is anything. So effectively, by doing an AND with 127, the rightmost 7 bits are preserved, the other bits are cleared, set to 0, and that gives me a character. And this is a traditional definition of what it means to cast an integer, which can be way bigger than the range of characters, into a char. Other languages that allow many more casts have all sorts of other arcane rules, but that's our particular one. So let's end the part two. Any questions on that? Yeah. Yeah, I guess we could. Say da 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 da. No, if I had something like 100 and I extracted the rightmost bit. What's happening here is we're following the rules. In many previous languages, there weren't Booleans. There were integers. And the rule was 0 is false and anything that's non-zero is true. And that's the pattern I'm following. I'm not sure if that was a great definition, but it exists in a lot of cases, that situation. You know, for example, you can do a conditional, you can call a malloc. Anybody's programming in C knows good old malloc. You can call malloc, and what happens is if you ask malloc for something it won't give you, it comes back with a 0. And you can see if it failed or not by simply saying if, take the result of malloc, and if it's true, you go ahead and use it. If it's false, i.e. zero, that means it failed and you go into a failure mode. And it all really bugs me because if and a pointer return from malloc, I mean, my God, pointers are complex things. They're, you know, 64 bits now because we have so darn much memory. But those O-style programming. So I guess, you know, once you're brainwashed forever. So they got me. Yeah, question. Assume what? Oh, it sure does. And more than a machine, actually the character code. I'm assuming ASCII here, because that's what everybody uses, I guess. The sort of situation, if Windows uses it and Mac OS uses it, the rest of the world should be doing it too. But that's absolutely false. Anybody from IBM land knows for a long time there's been something called EBCDIC, Extended Binary Code Decimal Interchange Code. So when you learn these things, they stick with you forever and situation. And that's 8 bits long, and IBM used that, and it gives you extra characters. And now these things, what's these things that, the new character code that Java's using, and rightly so, that's 2 bytes long for characters. What do they call that? The extended code that has all the various languages included. Excuse me? Unicode, yeah. And situation there is they do 2 bytes rather than 1, and now not only do they have the Roman alphabet, but they have most of the other languages in the world that have alphabets. So you have Arabic and Hebrew and Cyrillic and French with all the little accent marks here and there, and they actually have umlauts if you're in German, and for Spanish they have the tildes and all that stuff that I don't understand. And Hindu has a version in there, Korean has a version, Japanese has a version. Is there a version of Chinese that's included in Unicode? Yeah, I would hope that would be given. And so almost all the important languages and maybe some of the not so important languages. So if your language is important, I include it as important. I don't want to insult anybody. And I'm not assuming that at all. Maybe in future I would. But there's a lot of that done. It's situation there, and I'll apologize for it. But at some stage, we have to make some tangible decisions to make it all work. Anyway, let me get out of that, and we'll move on to... Okay, arrays and utility codes. It's going to turn out that JVM handles arrays rather differently than a lot of the earlier languages. And it's a question of whether you think this is right or wrong, but we're stuck with it whether you do or not. Initially, arrays, say at the C level and the assembly languages, were nothing but an assemblage of consecutive data of the same type. So if I would write down something like a sub 10, that means I want, say, int a sub 10, sorry. That means I want 10 consecutive integers. So this is really just a shorthand to say, Mr. Compiler, please give me 10 integers that'll be indexable. And we'll assume we're following the C convention that indexes by 0, so all the way up to 9. That's really all an array really was. And when you would write down, say, Mr. Compiler, I want you to write down a sub 3, and this is why it starts at 0, would say, well, what does that really mean? Well, it really means a sub 0 plus 3 times the size of an integer here, the size of an integer, which would be 4, and you take the address. Ampersand. The address of a sub 0, by the way, is oftentimes represented in C as A. So let's say this computation is nothing more than take the start address of A and add 3 times the length of the integers. And in many programs, that's exactly the way it stands. But it turns out this is one of the most dangerous aspects of programming languages and conditional language that exists, because there's absolutely no enforcement in almost any implementation of the fact that this subscript has to be in range. You can do all sorts of things like write a sub minus 99. Why would you want to possibly do a sub minus 99? That's right. What happens is, and no, it's actually years, but some other methods. What happens is one of the old style ways, which mostly now no longer works, to break into a computer system is to go ahead and have a call to a routine that has what's called super user access. And you would go in there and you say, it has super user access because it has to be able to do something with the data that I'm not allowed to do. And I go ahead and actually put a call that uses an array that either goes up or down beyond my frame. Remember, frames are just blocks of memory on a stack. And goes ahead and touches the piece of data that's being used by somebody in super user mode. And I go ahead and change that. So instead of saying clear benign location to zero, I clear maybe my current debt to the student, what do they call it? You know, the guys that paid for your student loans. And all of a sudden, wah, like that, all of a sudden your balance goes to zero. Isn't that cool? So we're going to talk after the break about arrays. And particularly, it turns out Java is much more careful about how it does arrays because it wants to avoid these sort of dangers. As a result, though, it's a little less efficient. And one of the ongoing things is, in computing businesses these days, we're comparatively rich. And one of the things you can do when you're rich is spend, in this case, resources you wouldn't otherwise spend. And that's exactly what Java does. It trades flexibility and efficiency for security. So we'll pick that up, and got about 15 minutes at 15:45, we'll start again.